turnstile manner. On the back surface of the washer, he has laid some conical elements. And in the center of the washer, he's bringing the coax cable down the axis of the washer. And let's say that the 12 o'clock element and the 6 o'clock element both connect to the shield. The 3 o'clock element and the 9 o'clock element both connect to the semiconductor. So the opposing elements are not fed out of phase, they're fed in phase. That's a wild way of doing it. And I'm having a little bit of trouble picturing what kind of signal gets put onto them and how it radiates. I think you got part of the picture there, Glenn. Go ahead.
It makes me wonder whether the piece of ferrite that he's using inside there with the coax is to actually create some kind of, instead of feeding them in phase, somehow to correct it again and put it back out of phase. I'm wondering if it's something crazy like that. But here again, it's certainly an antenna structure I'm not familiar with at all. So at this point in time, it leaves me completely blank. I'll pass it back over to you, Dick, but thanks for the explanation. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
You could say that the ferrite is wrapped up with the elements, but the ferrite is not around the coaxial cable per se. The ferrite washer occurs at the end of the coax cable where it joins the elements. So the ferrite is interposed within the elements, and the ferrite is not really there as far as the coax is concerned. And what the ferrite is doing is not clear.
Ouch. Sounds like more information needed. KC2QIQ.
In subject number 3, we have more about the balloons, but this one is the consideration for ultra-wideband, high-voltage balloon. If you open up this particular link, you can give a short introduction. So we consider that here how to build a balloon for the fast rise time pulses at high voltage. Now, the reason when I just read this first sentence, already remind myself the discussion that we have had about lightnings. A DC pulse without an offset that is creating a range of the harmonics because of the rise time. And we were thinking about what is actually causing that. Rise time or the full time or maybe just the rise time by itself. So let me go with that. Now, we consider that with hind signals with the rise times on the order of 100 to 200 picoseconds, with high peak voltages and peak powers, we propose that the simplest method is the coaxial unzipper. We consider the electric strength at maximum coaxial radius allowable while still maintaining the rise time. Also, considering our methods to reduce the coupling to the common mode. Again, he's trying to play with the same subject. Finally, we calculate that the peak electric field and characteristic impedance of the coaxial unzipper at various points along its length is using two-dimensional finite element code. And that's what basically this paper is about.
Yeah, when you have a rise time of 100 picoseconds, you're going to have a significant amount of energy out to 1 over that rise time, which is 10 gigahertz. So this thing has characteristics that go to as high as 10 gigahertz, is what he's basically saying, with high voltage. If you had 100 picosecond rise time pulses as part of a comb generator assembly, you would be making spectral components out to roughly 10 gigahertz, and then they would start falling off real fast. And I've done that. But he's not building a comb generator. He's just trying to build, what is this, a high-voltage pulse-generating circuit. Is that what it is?
Well, he is trying to approach the challenge of the single and its source. basically two challenges that could be associated with the single end source. First, the field is arranged so that it cannot be radiated efficiently. The radiated field on both sides for the antenna, transient antenna, is proportional to the integral of the aperture distribution for the coaxial geometry. This integral is exactly zero due to the symmetry consideration. Thus, the different geometry is required, so the balloon must be used. And that's why he used the balloon. And that's on the figure number 2-1.
Yeah, I read that with you. And so he's saying he's got a structure that does not radiate, and what does he intend to do with it?
Good question. Well, he is relating to different kind of the antennas using the same structure of the balloon. If you look right below that, a second difficulty with the coaxial geometry involves the excitation of common mode of an antenna, which decreases antenna efficiency. Consider the structure of figure. The exterior geometry consists three conductors, the exterior of the cable of two planes of the TM horn. There are three conductors can support two distinct modes, a differential mode and a common mode. The charges and electric fields associated with each of the modes is shown in figure 2.3. The differential mode is the mode that is desirable for the radiation, since it sets up the potential difference between the planes of the term TM horn. So, we're not talking about trying to strip antenna from the radiate, but he is using a differential mode that would be desirable for the radiation. Back to you.
Can you explain what he said, Dick?
Now, I'm looking at figure 2.3 right now, and I see what he's calling differential mode and common mode. Common mode is usually what causes the outside of your coax cable to radiate.
Here's some explanation. The common mode is essentially lost energy. It radiates in the wrong direction. Thus, we wish to minimize the energy in the common mode as much as possible. This is the second reason why balloons are necessary for this problem. And then, again, we're dealing with antennas.
Yeah, my understanding of common mode radiation on a coax cable really is the current that flows on the outside surface of the outer conductor. And whether you put a balloon at the end of the cable or somehow create an RF choke to stop the current from flowing down the outside of the conductor, you get the benefit we're usually looking for. Usually the radiation of the transmission line, because the transmission line is not in the right place, in the right polarity, it's wasted energy. So you don't like the transmission line to do the radiating most of the time, unless you're building a Herbie Snake antenna.
2.1, he has equivalent circuits for the common and differential mode.
Yeah, 2.3 is where he shows us the common mode and the differential mode.
3.1 is equivalent circuits of the common mode, and this is on page number 5. And what he says is, before building a balloon, we must first give some thought about the impedance at which we build the balloon. The output of this class of sources can be as low as 4 to 5 ohms. Antennas, on the other hand, tend to have input impedance of 100 to 400 ohms. The impedance at which a balloon is constructed can have a significant effect on the level of coupling to the common mode. Back to you.
So I think you're saying the common mode could have 4 or 5 ohms. The antenna is 100 to 400 ohms, and therefore the balloon, I guess, has to be very high in impedance compared to the 4 or 5 in order to stop the common mode from flowing. Is the 4 to 5 ohms referring to the common mode? He didn't say that.
That's what I believe. Let me jump. We consider highly, look at that page, figure 3.1, highly oversimplified equivalent circuits for the configuration. of 2.2. The equivalent circuit is shown on figure 3.1, and it assumes that the coupling to the differential mode and common mode can be modeled by simple resistance. In fact, the impedance is more complicated function of the frequency, but we still can obtain useful information with simple model. To achieve the best efficiency, the impedance of the common mode should be large with respect to impedance of the differential mode. Furthermore, the impedance of the differential mode should be much to feed the cable.
I jumped ahead to figure 3.2, and there he's trying to show what I believe is a slow transition. In other words, he's really starting off with triaxial cable. The coax is the center plus the next outer layer of it around it, and he has created a V-shaped curve, although he didn't show it, in the outer coax, and that as he goes down the coax, the V-shaped slot gets wider and wider. The transition picture shows you halfway. The third picture shows you 50-ohm twin lead inside of the shielded structure. So he has slowly transitioned from coax to twin lead.
Please add the common mode impedance by reducing exterior diameter of the feed cable.
Yeah. He didn't have to have that outer shield. He's doing that to be ultra careful. Lots of people have built a coax to twin lead transition, and as long as you do it slowly enough, you get a no standing wave ratio. You can end up with any output impedance versus any input impedance that you desire, and it becomes a thoroughly differential structure in the output, even though it starts off as an unbalanced structure in the beginning of the coax.
Well, yes, he is doing the trade-off against the dielectric strength of the material feeding the cable.
So he's trying to make a transition between coax and twin lead and trying to make it operate at maximum voltage all the way. Is that what he's trying to do?
He's trying to make the coupling to the common mode that could be obtained by that structure.
In the top of figure 3.2, it's not clear to me what that ferrite is doing.
Oh, good question. I don't know. When I relate to all of the papers, that we already discussed three papers of Mr. Baum. At first, he was playing with H-field and E-field and trying to separate them by using ferrites. Then he was playing with that antenna that we couldn't say too much about it. Now we went to the high voltage ballooning structure for the antenna. And now we're dealing with the slowing transmission or transition. And then it shows that on the left hand side that the circle is 50 ohm coax, then next circle on 3.2 is a transition, which shows kind of a curvy transition around the center, and then 50 ohm twin line, and 201 twin. Okay, so he is using the coaxial unzipper balloon by using different transmission lines.
I think he's trying to say he's slowly transitioning from one to the other, and if you do it slow enough in the change in impedances versus length, you get no reflections. Maybe his ferrite is trying to give him extra inductance per length to the common mode so that he can squeeze down the length of the whole thing and still have the same performance. Maybe that's what the ferrite is doing. He wants to do the transition in a smaller number of wavelengths of length.
So he's trying to make an arrangement to the common mode impedance in quite low. Since the cable is close to the conical arms, and better agreement with the higher common mode impedance would be to have the cable approach the feet from behind. And that's what he's trying to show in figure 3.3. And then a third agreement with the feet cable is attached to one of the feet arms. he says, but it would have to be possible, the advantage of distributing the conical geometry of feet arms near the apex where it is more critical. Kind of lost in it.
I just realized he's got a very terrible diagram here on 3.2. The upper portion of 3.2 really is trying to show you a piece of coax cable that is being split. It looks like there's three wires there. Those are not three wires. The I1 is the center conductor, which moves in a certain way as you go to the right. The I2 is the outer conductor, which is being sliced away, and it eventually ends up on a twin lead on the far right-hand side. So that is a very poor he should have done it as an isometric diagram. He did it as a pure slice. And it's very difficult at first to see, particularly where he's got wiggly lines. It's difficult to see that really represents a transition from coax to twin lead. Did you see that as a transition from coax to twin lead in the top of figure 3.2 the first time you saw it?
Well, I see that he's trying to reduce the coupling to the common mode by keeping impedance on the line low in the region of the transmission.
But he really has a piece of, in the top figure of 3.2, he's trying to show in cross-section a piece of coaxial cable on the left-hand side and a piece of twin lead on the right-hand side. And why he made the line squiggle in a funny way near the right is a little bit mysterious.
What I definitely see, yes, what that which he sees is mysterious, but what you definitely see is that he's using the ferroelectric sandwich to increase the common mode impedance.
I accept that. And that allows him to make the transition a lot shorter in wavelengths than he would have ordinarily. So the ferrite has given him the benefit of increased common mode impedance, and therefore he can decrease the length of the transition.
It makes sense. He's trying to reduce as much as possible the requirements for the ferrite, sees the behavior of the ferrite at fast rise time and high field strength remain somehow unexplored. That's what I see.
Dick, question?
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Dick, do you see the center conductor as those two wires as the one center conductor? Is that what you're saying about this poor illustration? Or is that bottom horizontal line in that diagram just framing it? That is a disgusting way to draw something.
No, the bottom horizontal line, the straight line on the bottom, and the I2 line, one is the bottom and one is the top of the outer conductor of the coax cable. So that's coax cable on the left-hand side. The I1 is the center conductor. The center conductor bends in a funny way and snakes down as it goes over to the right and ends up as the upper section of twin lead. So that bottom horizontal line represents the outer sheath of the coax cable. The upper horizontal line labeled I2 is the upper end of the coax cable outer sheath before you cut the V, and the V is causing that I2 to sneak down to the lower right, so to speak, and that really should have been shown as an isometric diagram as opposed to a pure cross-sectional diagram. That's a confusing diagram.
Go to 4.1?
I'm looking at 3.2, the top.
Yeah, I agree. That could have been drawn a lot better. In a couple of different ways, a lot better.
In page number 8, 4.1, coaxial geometry, he's showing the electrical characteristic of the coaxial cable. In doing so, he optimized the cable impedance in order to achieve maximum power transfer for given outer cable radius at maximum electric field.
Now, let me go back to John's comments. Another big mistake he made, when you look at the bottom of figure 3.2, bottom of figure 3.2, he's got a total of four cross-sections. The left-hand cross-section is a coaxial cable inside of a ferrite sheath. That's what it's trying to show. That's why it looks triaxial. Look at the diameter of the center conductor in the left-hand picture of the bottom of 3.2. That center conductor diameter is a hell of a lot skinnier than it is in the top picture. And then the center conductor on the third picture in the bottom of 3.2, the center conductor becomes a hell of a lot wider. And then the fourth picture, it becomes skinny again. He's got something really terrible there when it comes to the scaling factors between the lower pictures with each other and the lower pictures compared to the upper picture. He's not a very good artist.
No, that's for sure. This guy couldn't even do cartoon work. Nothing is consistent, and you're absolutely right. It's just like funny faces he's drawing there. Really weird.
You have to have a whole lot of a priori knowledge as to what a coax to twin lead transition traditionally is like. Otherwise, you would never understand what the hell he's trying to say here.
Also, I think the first round circle that he drew, the ferrite should have been shaded in a way to let you know that was a different structure or different material. That would have been a big help.
It sure would have.
Yeah, I'm looking at a page number 17, geometry for tracing the longest path through the balloon. That might give some, at the bottom of the page, that might give some clarity to that. What I understand is that he was based on the simple theory of the rise times. So he was trying to construct a simple model of the rise time of the unzipper balloon by comparing the length of the shortest and the longest ray paths. And this technique was kind of similar to one used earlier by him as far as the thickness of the wire. I remember what he was standing in the previous papers that at lower frequency, you're trying to keep the hole in or the space in the ferrite very small.
Illustration 6-1 is not much better.
No, he shows the input cross section, which he shows the z equals 0. Then output cross section, z equals l. This is the twin lead on the right hand side, and the path of the longest ray is at the bottom, between the twin lead structure.
Yeah, Wes, but I think also that first left view is again with a ferrite, not described. Then he leaves the ferrite out in the twin lead area, which both of the whole transition is encapsulated or within the ferrite core, so that should have been included.
He says that what he's driving you guys is to the unfolding of the structure. And unfolding of the structure is at figure 6.1, which states about to test the hypothesis of, in particular, to check the proportionally constant K from the previous section, because of the data available from the, or whatever. And he says, the reasonable approach to resolving discrepancy would be to build the number of balloons of this type and measure the fastest rise time that could be sustained in the future work. So, by on figure 6.1, he's slowly opening that circle with the center conductor in it, and showing how Z changes. Back to Dick.
Yeah, the slow transition is becoming a little bit more clear when you look at page 21. And does this thing have a... Yeah, figure 7.1. Figure 7.1, you start seeing the outer coaxial cable opening up wider and wider as he's transitioning between coax and twin lead.
but if you look, just quick look at page number 18, page number 18, 6.1, while the structure is opening. He's standing about 1 nanosecond rise time through the coaxial unzipper, and the diameter is 122 centimeter.
On the 6.1 figure, Z equals 0, it looks like a piece of coax. Z equals 2, it looks like twin lead inside of a slotted piece of coax. That's not clear to me as to what's happening. Is that a different kind of a balance?
It's the same balance. He's trying to show you what happened when you open it up. And he's showing the transition length. And he says, at the ARES, there is a correction. This ARES was his previous study. There's a correction on zipper SF6 where they wish to preserve a 1 nanosecond rise time through the coaxial unzipper. Those diameters are on 122 centimeters. So figure 6.2 on page 12 shows the transition length in, that is now 228 centimeters. Substituting all of the above information into the figure 6.4, we find that value K equals 1.8. This suggests that equation 6.4 is conservative by the factor 2.7. In other words, the transition has a length of 2.7 times shorter than equation requires and still maintains required rise time. While you're looking at it, I see something else. We consider here the solution of the problem we consider it to be typical. We wish to maintain 50 ohm impedance through an oil-filled unzipper section. Why is oil-filled? Because he's using extremely high voltages. And he uses the radius of 5 centimeters. Note that based on the result of section 4, one might wish to use somehow lower impedance for the oil field line in optimal power transfer if optimal power transfer is required. The analysis shows using two-dimensional finite element program called Maxwell. Oh, he was using Maxwell. I know that program from Ansoft Corporation. That's where he was doing all of this approximation and estimation, and he concluded that the highest electric field in oil occurs in the coaxial cable, and at points further along in the unzipper structure the peak field decreases somehow. What it may be useful later to provide similar analysis, nothing special. Yes, that's what you said at page 21, shows slowly opening a cross-section of the coaxial cable. And then following next one, it's fully opening. So on page 23, you have a full open transition. And then he shows the magnitude of electric field calculated by Maxwell.
Yeah, I went and looked ahead at those, and they make quite a bit of sense. I don't know on page 18 why, when I go from Z equals 0 to Z equals 2, why does the one dot in the center become two dots? What do the two dots represent?
Widening of the center conductor to keep the impedance.
Are the two dots showing you the outer edge of the center conductor and the center conductor is not there? Or are there really... is there a one dot for center conductor at Z equals 0 really becoming two dots? Does the center conductor split between Z equals 0 and Z equals 2? That's not clear.
But if you take the skin effect, then you have two dots. Well, when you look at the page 21, page 22 and page 23. Now you have the transition. And you see the center conductor, how it looks like.
Yeah, those pictures make sense. The pictures on page 18 don't make sense.
My understanding is that we're still dealing with one conductor only. We just have a relation between them that he's trying to keep by... if you take a look at the slotted line, you said you have a slot, the energy doesn't go out. Now, what's happened when you go open it up more and more and more and more? How would you keep 50 ohm impedance? That's what he's doing.
So I can see how you keep 50 ohms, and I can see how you keep it from radiating. As long as you make that outer slot in this outer conductor slow enough, and you keep controlling the diameter of center conductor and placement as you make the transition, and he slowly brings it over to two very fat oblong-shaped center conductor, twin lead. His final twin lead is really what I would call flat plate twin lead. What is the name for it?
At the same time, when you look at the Maxwell calculation drawing, he shows exactly what's going on with the magnetic field.
No, those are E-fields.
E-fields, I'm sorry.
A coaxial cable always has the strongest E-field near the center conductor. And the E-field, logically, you would think the E-field is... a constant magnitude as you go from center conductor to outer conductor. It's not. If you raise the signal stronger and stronger on a coax cable, you'll first start seeing corona near the center conductor.
Well, the characteristic of the balloon design will be a topper in the transmission line characteristic impedance. The output impedance of the high voltage sources would be around 5 ohms, whereas the typical antenna has the impedance of 100 to 400 ohms. So in the higher frequency, the peak voltage would be the half of Z. I don't understand that portion. What is he trying? He's trying to create a local characteristic impedance online. Then keep this effect, maintaining a constant peak of power. Now, what is really, for me, unexplained, and it caught my attention, page 34. Go to page 34, and then you see the wording. In the high frequency, early time, which is the second, the effect of topper transmission line. So we have a first three lines from the top, and then a space, and then we have a wording starting from in the high frequency early time. Again, page 34. For example, 1 megavolt signal at 1 ohm becomes a 4.5 megavolt signal at 200 ohms. This additional voltage must be considered in the design. Do you understand that?
Yeah, I'm going to jump back a little bit. Because he is building a EMP generator, and that's what's going on in Albuquerque. That's an EMP test facility. And the way they make the EMP is to have very high voltage capacitors, very high capacity capacitors charged to a very high voltage, and they discharge them in a hurry. That's the 4 or 5 ohm signal generator, the discharging capacitor. Most signal generators you and I can touch are 50 ohm signal generators. Because this is a charge capacitor impulse generator, that's where the 4 or 5 ohms is coming from. And he now wants to make megavolt out of this. A 1 megavolt signal at 10 ohms becomes 4.5 megavolt signal at 200 ohms. I'm going to study what that means in power. I'm going to do that right now. Stand by.
The excitement is killing me.
That's fine. This is N2XGM. And not often we have a situation in which the subject is doesn't go smooth. But it's about education and to exchange.
Yeah, I think he's rounding off the numbers a little bit. 1 megavolt at 10 ohms, he says, becomes 4.5 megavolts at 200 ohms. 1 megavolt across 10 ohms would be an amount of power flow equal to 100 gigawatts during that transition, during that interval of the poles. 4.5 megavolts on 200 ohms is 101 gigawatts. So he went from 100 gigawatts to 101 gigawatts. He's got a little bit more output than input. I think he's rounding off the numbers. That's why he's got a 1% error.
What I see, Dig, is he's, as a scientist, as a person who had an extremely good career, he's now trying to put a straightforward what he was basically doing all of the time. That's why he put all the papers together. If you look at his bio, you're going to be impressed.
The guy could have a very good track record, but he starts off with 100 megawatts, and he ends up with 100 gigawatts, and he ends up with 101 gigawatts. That's a good trick. But I think it's just because of the numbers being rounded off. That's a 1% error gain in energy, and I don't believe it.
In many other places, he was saying that he's playing with the electric E-field and H-field and trying to separate that. And then I found that the article from the Russian guy, and altogether I put in one contest. It just trying to hear your response to that.
Okay, portions of this make some sense. And the fact that he's starting off with coax, because that's the nature of his signal generator, and ending up with twin lead, because that's the way he wants to do the testing of the object under test in his EMP facility. And this is the transition that does the two, and it tolerates a megavolt in and 4.5 megavolts out, and hopefully it doesn't arc over, because he hasn't exceeded the E field of either the oil or the SF6, the sulfur hexafluoride. When people use sulfur hexafluoride, they're running around with high voltages and they don't want arc overs to take place. And the stuff has got a lot higher dielectric strength than most other gases. That's the good news. The bad news is that when sulfur hexafluoride does arc over, it gives you a poisonous result material. I think it ends up with, is it chlorine or phosgene? You end up with something you don't like, as I remember.
Dick, he says what this Russian guy was saying, and he didn't have any problem to say that because he didn't have such extensive scientific history, probably, that in this particular case, you have a little bit of over-unity.
Did he say somewhere that he expected to get over-unity, or is it just a round-off of some of the numbers?
I was looking at the numbers and went to the same conclusion that you came right now by calculating. And then I put together the paper with the Russian guy. This guy doesn't have a problem. He says, by shifting to the right the magnetic field, you're playing with E fields and H fields. And this guy, by the series of papers that he makes, he doesn't say it openly. He just show the numbers.
There is another interpretation here, though, that's not stated, and that is the 1 megavolt signal on 10 ohms at the source on that piece of coax cable has a certain pulse duration to it. Because of the accumulated inductance and distributed capacitance and everything else going through this transition, that even though the instantaneous power is a 1% gain, 100 gigawatts in and 101 gigawatts out, that doesn't necessarily equal more energy, because the pulse duration of the 101 gigawatts might be smaller. It may be of smaller pulse duration, so that the total number of joules of energy might be less instead of more. He didn't talk about the pulse duration.
Yes, but he says that we may think in terms of the circuit solution, let's say by comparison to the low frequency, that instead of the wave solution to the problem, so instead of thinking about terms of circuit solution, we have a wave solution to the problem. And that's another section of that says that one will need some resistor to dump out the low frequency reflection from the end of the balloon and antenna, or the device will look like an upper circuit. However, note that in many circumstances it is just the early time behavior of concern. He is giving doubts. That's what I see. Enter XGM.
On which page are you seeing these doubts?
Right below. That's the, when you were reading the 10 ohms becomes 4.5 millivolts, right below that, in the low frequency, late time. Whether he is doing that because he wants to protect yourself against the criticism, or he is trying to show that in low frequency now, we have a very different behavior. So he is relating that that phenomena occurs only to the certain range of the frequencies. With the guy who doesn't want to risk his back. That's what I believe.
Okay, so he's got a 200 ohm antenna, that's the reason he's doing this, that launches the EMP signal, but the 200 ohm antenna doesn't have a constant impedance DC to light. At the very low frequencies, it's an open circuit, so for the very low frequencies, he expects a reflected wave, is what I think he's saying.
That's what I believe it is. The conclusions says some put some lights on it, but before that, he says that we're interested in providing more accurate model of the effect separate transmission line, which would include the effects of intermediate frequencies. Now, intermediate frequencies, I relate in higher power lines. That's what we've heard before. We have that over voltages that appears to be. Whether these over voltages are created by intermediate frequency, we don't know that. But he says one-dimensional finite difference time domain analysis to model transmission, though the line varying impedance. From all this paper, what I've read, it looks like, okay, guys, I see something in here, and in previous papers I wanted to say something, that something is that I see the possible over-unity in the system, and by using the ferrite sandwich, we, or the balloon in different application, we come to one conclusion. We can get it, but although I don't want to say it. I didn't get to the Russian paper, I wouldn't even think about it. Okay, the guy is just speculating. But this Russian guy says and shows on that one page paper, shows on the third one. If we shift the magnetic field, now what are we getting?
Have you ever seen one of these lens impulse radiating antenna, IRA, impulse radiating antenna?
No, I didn't.
He says that's in reference 13. Reference 13 is EGFAR, off-boresight field of a lens IRA antenna, sensor and simulation. Now, there's a lot of these articles in a journal called Sensor and Simulation. I'm not familiar with that one.
The two-dimensional finite element analysis was performed at various points along the cross-section in order to calculate the impedance at the peak of electric field. Ultimately, the goal of the balloon is to provide suitable pit for an antenna. An approach for developing a suitable antenna for an output of an unzipper type balloon is to ask a lens impulse radiating antenna. So it looks like in all of his papers he's trying to point at the lensing effect as a factor for the phenomena that he's describing. And in comparison with the Russian paper, we know what he's driving to. Now, with the, if you look at the references, March 1993, that was probably 89, there is one paper, another paper, third paper, all of them from the from Baum. Then we have FAR, balloon consideration for the ferrite loading of the balloon to appear shortly at measurement note. Then we have Reinhardt, Smith, let me drop, Adler, Pulse, Power Formulatory, Martin, Young. Young is very man, Young is very known one. And then again Baum and Schlicher, this one I don't know the name. So he's referring to the number of papers, getting the very much consistent data, and trying to feed in between the words and message. That's what I believe is happening. But because this is about antennas, it's fine with me. It is the subject that you can help me out.
Yeah, it would be kind of fun to see what one of these impulse radiating antenna looks like. I have the impression it is a dipole-like structure. At least it's a thoroughly balanced antenna. Otherwise, you wouldn't be feeding it with this very bulky kind of twin lead.
If you go quickly to the subject number four, which is again Mr. Baum from May 5, 1991. As a matter of fact, Mr. Baum died. It's no longer with us. And he left impressive number of books and materials. Subject number four, main document, what is lensing effect and how it works? That's the question that I put on the top of it, and it's anisotropic medium for the high wave impedance.
Under subject number four, you've got two things that can be opened. Should I open the top one or the bottom one?
Open the top one, because the bottom one is the surface impedance and homogeneous type of plane wave and skewing stiffness upon the inclined anisotropic half space, and this is by different guy, but it's supporting. In other words, this paper is the supporting paper for Mr. Baum. So open the top one.
K2YO.
Go ahead, Bernie.
Dick, in the future, could you forward all of these links to the rest of us? Maybe put them out on the Limark email list so that we could kind of see what you guys are talking about? It's kind of difficult to follow along when you guys are talking about links and stuff and the rest of us can't see them or read them or understand what these things are. We do have a club email list, so that would very easily get this distributed out to everybody.
By the way, are you walking or running right now? You sound like you're winded. Go ahead.
No, I'm driving on a street in Queens, so we're getting beat up there. They graded the roadway off so that they can repave it. Should be settling down a little bit now, but they're repaving part of Queens Boulevard, and they got all the asphalt scraped off, so it's kind of a rough ride.
Boy, you sound like you were almost running. I was wondering if you were on a motorcycle or if you were doing running at the same time, Bernie. My goodness, that must be a rough road. Yeah, that's a reasonable request.
Okay, well, thank you, sir. Just my thought. I've been listening for a couple hours while I finished up my work this evening, so please continue on.
Okay, N2XGN. It looks like this one, the link that I gave you, is the link that we discussed already. It's It's a sandwich again. And by the way, I believe WA2RYY was the one who wanted to have a sandwich with the ferro resonance. that one we could look quickly because we don't have much time. It's just that all this material that I put you on that email. My question to you is: does it make a little sense to you, would I understand from that Mr. Baum was trying to do?
You're talking now about the stack of ferrites that were alternating high mu and high and low dielectric materials, low permittivity materials.
That is correct.
I think you're asking me, does that sound reasonable? And from what I know so far, it does sound reasonable, because the one thing you've got to worry about with ferrites is as you go up higher in frequency, you've got to worry about the eddy currents of the individual grains. You've got to worry about the conductivity between the grains as you go to higher and higher voltages. So the right sandwich of ferrites and low permittivity materials sounds like you can simultaneously get a medium amount of mu, a high amount of voltage, and not too much arcing over, so to speak. It does sound like it has certain advantages.
Yeah, in one place, he fit the worry I'm trying to find, that when you go with the sandwich structure, there is a certain length of the sandwich at which you're getting the expected results. In other words, the improvement of the sandwich provides over the solid ferrite. When you add that, at a certain length, you're reaching the property of the structure being within the expected range. When I was looking this over and over again, I found that, yes, he's fitting in various numbers of his articles. He's fitting the information that, guys, what you're going to be looking at is just put the slices in between, keep them, the dielectric slices half of the thickness of the ferrite, and then look at the certain length of that when you reach what I was talking about.
In about 60 seconds, we're going to be cut off. This was TechNet number 1358 of the series that began in September of 1982. Very slowly, we're making progress of trying to understand what Mother Nature has been telling us all these years. Bye-bye, you guys. We're not going to settle all this one tonight, I can tell. See you down the log. K2I, to be clear and listening, and I'm pretty sure we're going to be cut off in about a minute.
For my team, and all of the crew, for your contribution to the TechNet. This is N2XJ, and John, I'm going to 147.
73, Sick. See you next week. K4 and BC.
Bye-bye, Robert. And be careful on those tall structures. And by the way, you live in the lightning capital of the world. You got to be real careful.
The time is 1.
I am. That's why I'm still here.
2, the WQVL repeater.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
S12 WHCDL. wanted to check this system out. Thanks. Yeah, see you later, WC.
The time is 1:23 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL.